we come to our first speaker. Hello, gal. Who I saw come into the Monday group, and she was very quiet, and she rarely smiled, and it's been a great joy to see her bloom, and that's just the only word I can say. She has bloomed. Maxine?
My name is Max, and I'm a happy member of Al-Anon. If anyone had told me a little over 4 years ago that I would be standing up at this podium, you wouldn't have seen me for dust. Believe me. I, as most of them know that saw me come in, I didn't talk. I just passed all the time for about a year. I felt that I was so frightened that I spent all my time worrying about what I was going to say, and I didn't hear anything that anyone else said because I was so busy worrying. And so I finally came to the conclusion that if I was ever going to learn anything about this program, I was going to have to be quiet and listen, and I didn't care what anybody said. I was going to pass, and I did. And it got so that I would say, my name is Maxine, and I pass, and people would moan. And that's too bad, because that's the way it has to be. And I think it did have to be that way for me, because I was very frightened. I didn't want to even read. I was sure that when I opened my mouth, nothing would come out. I would clear my throat. I was doing that tonight, too. Paul and I were married many years, and actually I guess I thought of him as a social drinker. We had no problems, really. Suddenly that all changed, but I didn't think it was the drinking. I knew he drank, but I didn't connect that at all. I thought he was crazy. He had many, many weird ideas, and usually he would come along with these things, and I would go along with them up to a certain point. And then, as I remember one time, there was a big meeting out at the Disneyland Hotel for this Charles Simmons course. Maybe some of you have heard of this. And Paul insisted that we go out, and we went out, and I remember this man running up and down the aisles, and I was scared to death of him, and I thought he was a con man. I guess he was, because he spent some time in prison after that, I saw it in the paper. But anyway, this course was going to cost $700, and Paul wanted me to sign up. And I was terrified, because they had gotten people up on the stage, and they had to do things like walk like a duck. And I thought, I'm not going to do that. And that was the end of that. And I couldn't see spending the $700. Anyway, my solution was since Paul was crazy, I would go to a psychiatrist, and I would get him to go. And needless to say, this didn't work. I talked him into going once, and he was very belligerent and said he had nothing to say except what he could say in front of me, and the psychiatrist gave up, and I continued to go. I went, I think, to 3 or 4 different psychiatrists. I would go for a while. And then I spent all my time, though, reporting every week on what Paul did and what my older daughter did. And this is how I spent my time. And every week we had a new series. I didn't learn a thing about myself. I really wasn't looking for that, I guess. I don't know. But I said this the other day at a meeting, I went really thinking, what am I supposed to say? What is expected of me? And I didn't know. I didn't know what what you were supposed to do when you went to a psychiatrist. I never mentioned anything about the drinking because, like I say, I didn't think the problem was drinking. After my husband got on the program, I found out that he did a lot of drinking after I went to bed. This seemed to be a big problem because I don't know why he wanted me to stay up, but he did. We would sit in the living room, and he would watch television, all 13 channels at once. And I don't care much for television anyway, and I would think, well, you know, we're supposed to spend some time together, even though we didn't talk. So I would just get interested in a program, and he'd switch to another channel. And I just drove me frantic. I kept thinking, I wish I could go to bed. But I couldn't go to bed until 11 o'clock. I don't know what I thought 11 o'clock had to do with it, but this was my time when I thought I could go to bed. And then I would go to bed, or sometimes I would decide that now it was time to talk and we would get all these things straightened out. And, oh, God, what a mess that was. It always ended up, I cried, and Paul was mad. And yet that didn't keep me from trying again. I would do it again whenever I felt that I had to talk to him and get usually about the kids. And he didn't want to talk about it. And he'd say things like, why don't you make an appointment? And then I would get my feelings hurt. But anyway, it just wasn't very successful. And another thing I did, I ran to priests. But I never went to our parish priest. I would go off someplace. I picked the chaplain at St. Joseph's Hospital, and I went over and talked to him, and I didn't tell Paul I was going, and I was gone for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and he said, well, what we usually do is I talk to the wife, and then I talk to the husband, and then I talk to the two of you. That was fine. So then I had to go home and explain to Paul where I had been, and I went home, and I told him, and I said, will you go over and talk to him? And first he said no, but anyway, I talked and talked and talked. I guess the alcoholics are not the only con artists. I did a lot of talking them into things. And he went over the next day, and he came home, and he was furious, just furious. And wouldn't tell me what happened. And I thought, well, you know, I thought we were supposed to go over and see the priest together and get all this straightened out. So he wouldn't discuss it at all. So the next day I called the priest and I said, what happened? And he said, your husband is the most stubborn man I have ever seen. He said, there's no use having a joint meeting. So every time, everything I tried, it just didn't work because, well, he wasn't very cooperative. Anyway, I guess in the 3.5 years, like I say, I would go to one I went to 6 months, and I didn't like him too well because he laughed whenever I said anything, and so I didn't care much for him. And then Paul got the idea that maybe he would take a hypnosis course. No, he was going to take, he had taken hypnosis courses, and he decided that I was such a mess that maybe I should be hypnotized. So, anyway, it took me clear over to Westwood, I think, to some psychologist who had taught one of these courses. And he took me over there 6 Wednesdays. I don't think much was accomplished. Finally, the fellow decided maybe I should go to a psychologist in Anaheim. So I went there. But anyway, when I told the first psychiatrist that I was going to be hypnotized, he said, if you do that, don't come back. And I was glad, because I didn't like him anyway. But then I went to the other fellow for about a year and a half, and I really, I guess I got rid of a lot of my hostilities, a lot of my, well, at least getting to talk to somebody, because I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't tell anybody these problems. And then I quit him, and then the next thing I'd know, I'd be all mixed up again, and then I'd find somebody else. And then this time I found somebody in Long Beach because I didn't want to run into anybody I knew. Paul referred people to psychiatrists too, and it would be kind of embarrassing if I were there when they came in. I continued like this. I don't think I allowed my, I felt numb really most of the time. I wouldn't allow myself to have any feelings. I didn't know I was doing this at the time, but that really was the only way I could be comfortable. If I had no feelings, I couldn't be hurt. I had this feeling of impending doom. I felt something horrible was going to happen. I didn't know what or when, but I knew something was going to happen. And Paul would reinforce this too, because he told me this all the time, that this was going to happen. Something was going to happen. And I really didn't know where to turn. Different doctors talked to me, and they would talk about Paul's change of personality, and I would agree with them. But I didn't want to discuss it with anybody, because I thought, my God, if I told anybody we knew, Paul would kill me. He'd just kill me if I discussed anything with him. And I also knew that he was taking pills, and my I was focused on the pills. Everything, I didn't think this was making him crazy. I found out afterwards that actually some of the pills he was taking was making him psychotic. At the time, I didn't know this, so I guess I wasn't too wrong in thinking he was crazy. This went on and on. Another thing that I did, I had many methods of escape. I used sleep. I could lie down and sleep almost any time. This first psychiatrist told me, asked me if I had a hobby. So I thought, well, that's the answer. I should get a hobby. I didn't have any hobbies. So I didn't know what to do. So the first thing I thought of, heard about somebody had a knitting machine, and I could get 10 free lessons, and so I would do that. I went out and bought a knitting machine, and I took the lessons, and I still can't knit with that dumb thing. I bought an organ, and I took 10 free lessons, and I still can't play the organ. Another thing that I did, I worked in my husband's office, and I didn't like being home, so I would go down to the office Saturdays and Sundays and type insurance forms. That way, I didn't have to be home, and I had a lot of work to do, and I liked Paul to know that I had a lot of work to do, because he really didn't appreciate me. He was always telling me that he could hire anybody to do the things that I did, and that he wouldn't have to take all the stuff from them. Then I used to get mad and think, well, I'll show you. I'll go get another job. And I would look in the paper and look through the one ads, and that's as far as it went, because I was afraid. I was afraid. And I had worked all our married life, really. And I thought I couldn't get a job. So I was stuck. I was stuck in the office, and he was stuck with me. Finally, with all this mess, Paul had a convulsion. Well, first he had pancreatitis, and I didn't think too much about that, because I don't really know that much about medicine. Then when he had the convulsion the first time, I got very excited, and I called the doctor in the next block, and we took him to the hospital, and he stayed overnight, and I stayed with him. And he came home the next day and everything was fine. In that time, he saw a neurologist, and he didn't know why he had a psychiatrist. Of course, Paul didn't mention either that he drank or took pills, and I didn't either. And then I think it was about 14 months later that he had another convulsion. This time, when he had the convulsion, he was in the bedroom, and I just sat down on the edge of the bed and watched him and waited. And when he got through, I said, "You've had a convulsion. You better go to bed." And he did. The next day, I talked him into calling as a neurologist. In the meantime, different things would go on, and like I say, I didn't try to get medical help because I was afraid to go to any of the doctors we knew. But this poor fellow happened to be in Santa Ana, and I didn't know him socially, and every time something would happen, I was on the phone with him. And I think he got kind of sick of me. Anyway, when Paul had the second convulsion, before that time, he had gone to him, or the two of us had gone to him, and he refused to have any lab tests and said that the problem was neural. And I couldn't quite figure out how I could cause him to have a convulsion, but if he said so, it must be true. I believed everything he told me. I don't know who was sicker, him or me. I thought he was crazy, but still I believed everything he said. Anyway, when we called this neurologist this day, like I say, I think he was pretty sick of me. So he suggested that Paul go to the Mayo Clinic. And I don't think he wanted to touch us with a 10-foot pole. Paul wasn't very cooperative, and I guess he thought I was crazy. Anyway, the arrangements were made, and we had to wait a month before I could get into the Mayo Clinic. And in that time, Paul would be going, and then he wasn't going. Then he was going, and then he wasn't going. And I'm telling you, that month, I was frantic because I thought this is my last chance. If he doesn't go now, I didn't know what I would do. I really didn't. So anyway, the last minute he decided he would go. And we went up there and went through all these tests. And then he called me from over at one of the doctor's offices, and we were staying in this hotel, and said that they wanted to put him in the psych ward of the hospital. And it was, I think, the day before Christmas. And so he went in the psych ward, and I could go to see him 1 hour. And he had to stand in line outside of this locked steel door. Anyway, I would go in, and he was laying on the bed, and he wanted out. And he told me that if I didn't agree to sign him out of the hospital, he would never speak to me again. So, you know, what could I do but agree? We'll do that. Anyway, he signed himself out, and we came back. I don't know if it was a day or two. He signed himself out on Christmas Day, and I guess we came back the next day. And, of course, he promised me that he wouldn't drink, he wouldn't do anything. And we got on the plane, and we had a big fight over whether or not he was going to drink the free booze. I won. He didn't drink, but he also didn't eat, and he pouted all the way back. You know, this is very upsetting to a non-alcoholic because I was ready to take responsibility for anything he handed me. It was my fault. Anyway, the next morning, again, I was very upset, and the next morning I was up at 4 o'clock, and I couldn't wait for 9 o'clock so I could call the doctor to tell him what happened. And in the meantime, I called my brother-in-law back in Ohio, and I was really a little busy beaver that morning, calling everybody I could think of. Anyway, when I told the story to the neurologist, he said, "Do you think he'll see a psychiatrist here?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I'll ask him." And when Paul got up about 3 o'clock, I presented this to him, and he agreed, and I was kind of surprised. But anyway, we went, and needless to say, the psychiatrist put him in the locked ward here. I still was very confused. I didn't really know what was going on. I would go over to see Paul again. I could see him for an hour every day. And I would go over, and I would just get there, and he'd say, "Why don't you go home?" And I would just sit. I'd just sit for the whole hour. And we didn't talk, you know, other than him giving me orders of what I was supposed to do. And when he was in the hospital, I felt like I wanted to go to bed and just pull the covers right up over my head and not see anyone and not talk to anyone. And sometimes I didn't answer the phone. And maybe part of this was the fact that most of the time it was Paul telling me something more I could do. I remember he sent me over to the central office to get the big book, and I had no idea why. I was just completely out of it, I guess. Anyway, when he was in the hospital, the fellow who was taking him to meetings, and I don't remember either how long he had gone to meetings, I happened to go over on a Saturday night, and this fellow said, "We're going to an AA meeting. Would you like to go?" You know, I didn't know what it was. I had heard of AA. I had even heard of Al-Anon. In fact, about 6 years before that, I had sent for Al-Anon literature for the office. And I found this after I was on Al-Anon. But it made no impression on me at the time. I don't think I would have come to Al-Anon on my own in 100 years, really. Like I said, I just didn't think the problem was alcohol. But anyway, I went to the Canyon Club on the Saturday night meeting, and I knew there was something there. I called it enthusiasm at the time, but I could feel it in the room. These people had something that I thought that I had been searching for through all these other things, and I was really fascinated. And I didn't really know that there was more than 2 meetings a week, because we only went to the Wednesday night meeting and the Saturday night meeting. And I thought, well, I never saw a directory or anything, and I didn't know. And I really looked forward to them. As I said, our communication was very, very bad during the drinking time. We just could never talk. And most of the time, if Paul were in the bedroom, I was in the living room, and if he were in the living room, I was in the bedroom. We didn't spend too much time with each other. And this was the first time in a long time that we'd really done anything together. But by that time, I had given up, really, in trying to make him talk. And for the first time, I was comfortable without talking. And we would ride down from Anaheim to Laguna, and neither one of us say a word, and just ride. And I used to be obsessed with what he was thinking, you know, and try to find out what he was thinking. This made him mad, too. But anyway, eventually we started to talk about what the speakers had said. And this was a start. After a good 2 years on the program, we started to share feelings rather than thoughts, because I had spent years thinking that if I just worded it the right way, then he would understand and he would agree with me. And then I kept trying different ways. and it was very important to me that I be right. And I this made him furious too, because he would say to me, "I don't mind you being right, but you're so damned right." Now I understand what I was doing, but at the time it was very important to me, because I would always figure everything out logically, and that's the way it was. There just wasn't any other way. And he would accuse me of things that we did everything my way, and I would just be horrified to think he'd say such awful things about me, because I wasn't like that at all. I was a real nice kid, I thought. Anyway, like I said, it was over 2 years on the program before we were really able to communicate feelings. And that's been a real big breakthrough for us. There's quite a difference between what you think and what you feel. And people can't argue with how you feel. It's quite a difference, and I found it very exciting. I also had trouble conveying how I felt, because I kept my emotions so well under control, I didn't know how I felt. And I think I was on Al-Anon 3 years before I was able to know how I felt about many, many things. And then after I found out how I felt, then it was hard to put it into words. Another thing that we have found on the program is that we no longer have expectations of the other person. And I think this causes a lot of trouble in married couples' lives, because they expect the other person to act a certain way. And if they don't, then they're disappointed. And that has helped a lot. Paul can have a different opinion than I do, and that's right for him, and what I think is right for me. And we're able to give the other person the right to feel the way they want to. Going back to the drinking time, some of the crazy things I did, Paul decided that he would lock the bar. We have a bar with folding doors, and he would lock the bar so that he wouldn't drink. He would always tell me this stuff. That's why I don't understand why I didn't realize the problem was drinking. But I just thought, well, this is one of his kooky ideas. He'd say things like, "I'm not going to drink anymore, and so let's pour all the beer out." So I would open the cans and we'd pour the beer down the sink. And the only thing I got out of that is I think, well, I'm not going to buy that much anymore, because this is a waste. And then that night, he would say, "Go get me 3 beers." And we'd argue about this for a while, and I'd always end up going and getting it. And then I'd think, well, you know, after I went to get it, I could have one. And then he would be mad, and he didn't want me to have that one beer. And I couldn't understand that. After all, I'd been good enough to get it. And he also locked the bar, as I said, and then he gave me the key. And we would play this little game where I would hide the key in the bedroom, and then at night when he would tell me this, that he needed just one drink so he could sleep, and we'd argue a little while, and always ended up the same way. I would go get the key, and we'd have a little drink, and then 11 o'clock I'd go to bed. As I was saying, my first exposure was AA, and I was very enthusiastic about it. I was exposed to Al-Anon at that time. I think I came to maybe 3 meetings, and I didn't want to talk, and I didn't like women's clubs anyway, and I knew I never would tell the things that the women in the meeting told about themselves. And besides, I worked. That was a real good excuse. I used this for everything I didn't want to do. I worked. I didn't have time. So I quit going to Al-Anon. besides, everything was better. We were talking a little bit, and things were better at home, and I guess I thought I didn't need it. I don't know. I really didn't think that out too clearly either. We came to the program in '67, January '67, and every time Paul and I would have an argument about something, he would punish me and say, I'm not going to the AA meeting. So I would get dressed, and I was afraid to ride on the drive freeway, and I was afraid to come down the canyon road. This was before they fixed this. But I was determined that I was going to come, and I did. I came by myself. I'd come to the Wednesday night and the Saturday night meeting. I think this happened 3 or 4 times. And Paul never asked where I went. I guess he knew where I went. And when we came together, we came late. If we got down here for the Wednesday night meeting too early, we would go up to Denny's and have a Sunday or soda, because we didn't want to get here before time. And then as soon as they said the Lord's Prayer, we were out the door. And then on the way home, we'd say, well, those people aren't so friendly. They talk about... they talk about the meeting after the meeting. Nobody ever talked to us. Anyway, that's the way it went. And in '67, they had the convention in Anaheim, and we didn't know too many people, but we went, and it's very close to our house, and so we would pick out the meetings we wanted, and then we would run home. And on Saturday afternoon, and I still don't know why I stayed, because it wasn't like me to do things on my own. But there was an Al-Anon meeting, and Paul decided to go home, and I stayed. And I went in this big room, and I remember Martha came up to me, because I was sitting in the back by myself, and I was scared. And she came up to me, and she said, "Why don't you come and sit with us?" And I did, and I felt more comfortable, and I've always been very thankful to Martha that she did that. Anyway, the meeting was on release, and I was very impressed, and I thought, gee, you know, these women do have something. I guess you didn't think, or I didn't think you did, because I was getting all I needed out of the AA meetings, because I identified with the feelings of the alcoholic. I don't even know where I was. Anyway, things went on like that, and like I say, we now have very good communication, and because we can give the other person the right to their own opinion and their own feelings. And this is great. I think it's a great way to go. I didn't think that we would ever accomplish this. I know that people look at you after you've been on the program a while, and they think you've always been that way. I had somebody say that to me the other night. They said, "Well, Paul always talked." I said, "No, he didn't. He didn't. We changed quite a bit." I'm very grateful to the program. It's made a great difference in our life. I'm glad that Paul didn't push Al-Anon. He didn't know what it was. That's probably why he pushed. Pushed in every other area. He was always telling me what to do. And I remember he used to get quite upset with me, because I'm the type of person that didn't argue. He would suggest that I do something, and I wouldn't argue, but I just wouldn't do it. And then he would say, "You told me you would do it." Of course, I hadn't told him. I hadn't said anything, but I guess he figured that I was agreeing. Anyway, I started going back to Al-Anon, like I say. I came to the Monday noon meeting, and when I came back after those 10 months, I don't think I saw more than half a dozen people that I'd even seen before. So it was hard for me to come back, and to because I'm not a very outgoing person. I still find it difficult to go up to newcomers and talk to them, because I always think, well, what do I have to say? I can't talk to them. If the person came to me and talked to me, that would be fine. But I hope that I get over this, because I think it's very important that you do this to make people feel friendly. In the beginning, the only thing that I knew was I felt better when I went to the meetings than when I didn't. And this kept me coming back. If there are any newcomers here tonight, I think it's very, very important to go to lots and lots of meetings. For one reason, you may not hear at the first meeting or the meetings you go to what you want to hear. But eventually, somebody will say something that you identify with. And it's the feelings that we identify with. And like I say, I passed for a whole year. And that was the only way I could be comfortable, to come to the meetings and know ahead of time that I wasn't going to talk. And I think, as some of you know, I think Sarah was one of the ones who asked me if I would lead. Oh, no, 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 I wasn't going to lead. I think it was almost 2 years before I would agree to lead to a meeting. And then I was very careful when I would lead. I decided that I would lead the Monday after the convention, because there wouldn't be that many people there. And then after that, I was talking to someone, and they said, oh, well, why did you leave a speaker meeting? Then you wouldn't have had to talk at all. I hadn't even thought of that. It's the usual thing. I was so busy trying to figure everything out, I didn't come up with the right answer at all. I have always been a person, like I say, who felt they were right, and it's been very difficult for me to give up trying different methods. And even after being on Al-Anon for 4 years, I still will do this. I will try all my methods first. And then when I think, oh, well, I really don't care, then something happens that's much better than anything I would have thought of. But I guess it's getting better, because first you have to become aware, and I think you have to have a little success first. And when you find out that things do work, you're more willing to try them again. At least that's the way it's been with me. I guess I have to be convinced of everything, and I have to find it out for myself. Nobody else can tell me. I'm pretty stubborn, as my husband will attest to. Like I say, we have a great life now. I don't think I had so much trouble releasing Paul as I did my older daughter. And my obsession seemed to go from Paul to her. And I didn't want to give that up for a long, long time. And in the beginning, I would come and I'd listen to the things they said about release with love. And I thought I understood, but now I know I didn't. And finally, somebody said something about emotional detachment, and this made more sense to me. I was able to understand that better. And it means the same thing, really. But I think that's what I mean when you should come to a lot of meetings, because somebody will say it the way you understand it. But anyway, when I finally did release my daughter, I knew it, And I was very excited, and I remember coming to that Monday meeting, and I couldn't wait to tell Elsa because I had told her before. And you know, I was so anxious to talk at that meeting, and you know what happened? They didn't call on me when I had something to say. But when I could sit across the table from her and listen to all her problems and not feel sick to my stomach and this churning inside, that to me is relief. I just didn't get emotionally involved in her problems. And I can't afford to. Even now, I cannot emotionally afford Ann's problems, or anybody else's for that matter. I also did that with a gal that I brought to meetings in the beginning. She's quite a bit younger than I, and I listened to all these things that she told me, and I wanted to help so badly. I wanted to help. And I was exhausted. And then I know you can't. This is a self-help program. You do it yourself when you're ready. I like the part that they read, I think it's the three deadly enemies. They say, you do it in your own time, in your own way. I like that, because it took me a long time. I think Al-Anon is unlearning as much as it is learning, and I had to unlearn a lot of things that I thought were right. Another thing, and some of you have heard this too, I really think that the Al-Anons are sicker than the AAs. And you don't get well overnight either. After we had been around 2 years, the first year, like I say, people weren't very friendly. And so we didn't know very many people. And we heard about these Christmas parties that were being given and couldn't understand why we weren't invited when all these other people were invited. And so the next year, when we finally started to talk and people maybe knew who we were, or at least that we were around, we got invited, and I was very excited, and I really was looking forward to this. And so the day came to go to the party, and my husband decided to have a depression. He went to bed. I coaxed, I cried, I threatened, I did all the things that I used to do, and he still wouldn't do what I wanted him to do. So I thought, okay, I'll show you. I'll just commit suicide. And so I went out in the drawer, and I had plastic bags in that drawer, and I took one out. It was all folded up, and I took it out, and I went down to the office, and this was between Christmas and New Year's, and the office was cold. The heat wasn't on. And I went in, and I opened up this bag, and it was full of holes. So that stopped that. And so I went in and laid on the EKG table, and I was madder and madder and madder, and I thought, he can't do this to me. I'll just go to the party by myself. So I went home, and he's still in bed, and I had to get all my clothes out of the closet in the dark, you know, feel around and dress in the bathroom. So I got all dressed, and I got down there pretty late. And everybody that asked me, where's Paul? I said, he's mad. And this was not like me, because I always covered up. He had a call, or he couldn't make it. But I didn't. I guess I'd had enough Al-Anon by that time that I decided that I was going to tell people the truth. And I remember Jack N. was there, and he was also alone, and I was mad, and I had, I think, 3 bottles of booze in my car that Paul had gotten for Christmas. That was always a big problem, what I was going to do with all this booze we got for Christmas. And I said, too bad you don't drink or we'd get drunk. And he teases me about that, yeah. Anyway, I stayed late. I think I was one of the last ones to go home. And the next day, Paul didn't ask me where I'd been. And the New Year's Eve meeting was coming up at the club, and I didn't know whether we were going or not. And anyway, he condescended to go, and we still weren't talking. And we walked into the club, and Elsa came up and said to Paul, well, are you over your mad? And I thought I would die. Anyway, it cured him. Yes, and had a good suicidal depression since. But that's the way it has worked for us. And I want to read a little poem that some friends of us gave us, a plaque. And I think that it sort of sums up Al-Anon NAA. I do my thing and you do your thing. I am not in this world to live up to your expectations, and you are not in this world to live up to mine. You are you and I am I, and if by chance we find each other, it's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Maxine. I think that was wonderful.